So, take two. We're on Pursuit of Peace in the Home. Last week we began by looking at wedding blessings and the idea of building an enduring house, an enduring home. We talked about the importance of peace in maintaining the home. We talked about the big three, the focus on the relationship with God, the focus on service of God, the focus on community, and the importance of those social relationships which are preserved by peace. That moved into a discussion about how marital strength is emphasized within Jewish law. We talked about the practice of staying home within the first year. We talked about the wife's ability to limit where the husband goes on his business trips, as well as the rule that he has to be home for dinner. And that brought us to sort of more complicated questions, which is where we value peace when it competes with other values. So last week we talked about the question of preserving peace at the expense of honesty, and the question of whether that's appropriate, whether someone should lie in order to keep the peace. I'm going to move on from that case to a second case. This one always is always interesting. It's in source number 14. There are a couple of different versions of this story around in different rabbinic texts, but I brought you one. Source number 14 on last week's sheet, the one that has at the top week one, peace in the home. Story goes like this. For those who don't have a sheet, you can listen and hopefully not fall asleep. Rabbi Meir would teach in the synagogue in Hamat every Friday night. Now, teaching a class Friday night, frankly, is always dicey. But all right, he taught a class every Friday night. And a certain woman would go to listen. Once Rabbi Meir extended the lesson. He went on for a long time. And when she arrived home, she found that the lamp had burned out. Her husband said to her, "Where were you?" She said to him, "I was listening to the lesson." And he said to her, "By such and such," he took an oath, "you may not come into this house until you go spit in the face of the teacher." Now, what was the husband so angry about? I'm assuming this was after dinner she had gone to the lesson. Not that, you know, she had been at the lesson and therefore they didn't get to eat dinner until the candle went out. But it's possible that it was delaying dinner. Also worth noting that historically and certainly Talmudically, Friday night was a time for the husband and the wife to be together, and maybe that was the concern. She was out of the class instead. So Rabbi Meir is described in the Talmud as seeing with divine inspiration. This is something called in Hebrew Ruach HaKodesh. It is not prophecy, but it is some kind of special insight God may grant people either who are righteous or people in particular situations when God wants something to happen. Rabbi Meir is granted this special insight, and he realizes what has happened. Maybe he just saw her leave the class late and thought, you know, I'm in trouble now. But he has this inspiration, this Ruach HaKodesh, and he pretends to have an eye ache. He pretends that there's something wrong with his eyes. Often in the Talmud, when it says an eye ache, often it's a headache, sort of a headache in the front of one's head. But he said, "If any woman knows incantations for the eye, let her come perform them." If anyone knows, you know, this is the state of medicine a couple of thousand years ago. If you know how to treat an eye that's hurting, you know, do something, please. And her friend said to her, "This is your opportunity to go home." Apparently the husband is serious. He's keeping her out of the house. "This is your way back in. Pretend to perform an incantation for him and spit in his eye." So she goes to Rabbi Meir, planning to actually carry this out. And he asks her, "Are you wise? Do you know how to perform an incantation for the eye?" And she's intimidated. She's not going to lie. She says, "No, I actually don't know. I don't know what I'm doing here." He told her, "Spit in it seven times, and that will be good for it." That's what he tells her to do. And after she had spit, he told her, "Go tell your husband, you told me to do it once, and I did it seven times." letting her in on the fact that he knew, you know, what had been going on, and that it's okay for her to have done what she did. He set up the opportunity for her to be able to go home. Now, the truth of the matter is, there's a whole other piece of this story, which is what kind of relationship are, you know, this husband and wife have, and really, is going home necessarily the best, you know, the best thing for her? That's a whole other piece of this conversation. But that's not the part that I want to focus on within the story, as much as the question of what you're willing to do in order to achieve peace. Right? Rabbi Meir is sacrificing the honor of his position, not to mention it's gross, right, in order to arrange some kind of detente between husband and wife. Stephen, you were going
to
say?
What was her husband willing to do?
We don't know. We're missing the bigger picture here. We don't know anything about this relationship. We don't know anything about how long they had been married, what the history was between them, and we don't know what happens afterwards. We don't know if they stay together afterwards or if they split up. We don't know how long she was out of the house. We don't know if this story all plays out within a day or two, or was this something that dragged out over time. We're not given enough information to analyze this marriage. Yeah. Yes. Saliva in the eye, believe it or not, could have been considered therapeutic. We've come a long way. The core point, again, I want to sort of, even though it's a great story and there's a lot of fun to sort of think about, the part that I want to emphasize is the valuing of peace. We saw last week valuing peace over truth. We're talking about here valuing peace over ultimately the position of Rabbi Meir, who is the leading rabbi of his day. Rabbi Meir is the leading rabbi of his time. His chief student is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who is the one who canonizes the Mishnah. And whenever the Mishnah records a law, and it doesn't say Rabbi so-and-so said, it's assumed to be Rabbi Meir, and the reason why you don't need to say who said the law is because if Rabbi Meir said it and everybody agreed with it and everybody's good with it, so you don't need to assign it to a particular person. So this is not just a rabbi in a synagogue who taught a class Friday night. This is the rabbi. The Rabbi Meir is the top. So I think that's important to keep in mind. So we're valuing peace so high that we're putting it over the honor of the sage as well as truth. And then one more. There is a biblical mitzvah. You've probably heard about it. Perhaps you even tried to implement it with your children. And that's the mitzvah of honoring your parents. Right? We are familiar. Five. Number five in the top ten. So, take a look at this very interesting law recorded by Maimonides in source number 15. This law comes up actually quite a bit. If a man says to his wife, "I don't want your father, mother, brothers, sisters, whatever the case may be, to enter my home," we listen to him. We do not compel someone to permit others to enter his space. And so too, if she says, "I don't want your mother, sisters entering my home, and I won't live in the yard with them," because the yard, again, urban architecture in those days, it meant having houses that abutted the same courtyard, right? So I don't want to be on the same courtyard as them because they harm me or pain me. We listen to her. Neither one can compel the other to accept their in-laws into the home. The phenomenon of in-laws and in-law jokes and so on is not new. It's actually extremely old. The Talmud has a discussion about testimony that one's spouse has passed away. Right? To avoid an aguna situation, a situation in which someone is not able to remarry and their spouse has died, we have certain leniencies in terms of the type of testimony we're willing to accept. So, the Talmud actually lists which relationships we don't trust. Who within a family is not credible to testify that a person's spouse has died? And one of them is, a rival wife cannot testify about the other one. That's one example. But another one is the in-law. Meaning that, let's say, a woman's mother-in-law is not credible to testify that her son has died. Because there's a concern. The son may just be away, and she's going to take the opportunity to mess things up for her daughter-in-law, who will now go off and get remarried to somebody else, and then the husband's going to come back. There's a concern for that level of sabotage. So the, So in-law things are not new. In-law issues are very old, probably as old as marriages. But the point that Maimonides is making here is that even though it's honor for one's parents to welcome one's parents into the home, peace with the spouse is going to come first. So that's, I think, an important point to recognize. So the last part that I wanted to do within this topic of how we approach peace in the home is to talk about one particular Talmudic discussion, which I think is very relevant here. The Talmud is having a discussion that's not about peace in the home at all. It's a discussion of Beit Din, rabbinical courts. When people show up in court, in any court, rabbinic court, secular court, whatever type of litigation, there's always a choice in front of them. They can choose to litigate, or they can choose some alternative form of dispute resolution. They could have a mediator, they could have some kind of arbitration. There are different approaches that they can choose, and rabbinical court is no different. The question arises, though, if parties show up in a court and they want to litigate, and they want to hear what does the Torah say, are the judges entitled to try to promote a compromise instead? Is it okay for the judge to say, you know, I'd rather you first try to come to a negotiated settlement before you pursue a verdict based on the Torah's laws? What would you say? Is it appropriate for the judge to recommend that they try some kind of compromise?
Yes.
Sorry? Yeah. So, I'm hearing a consensus of yes, whether it's because you come to the rabbi with many questions or just in general, it makes sense to pursue peace and to pursue compromise. What's the opposing argument? Why would one say potentially not? Yeah.
Well, maybe the rabbi or the judge sees that this couple will never get along. It's just an exercise of futility, so they might as well.
Well, I'm not dealing with a couple here. I'm dealing with litigants who show up in court. What would be the reason not to argue for compromise?
Because maybe the rabbi is biased with one party.
Well, there are different ways that they could try to arrange their compromise. It doesn't have to be on the rabbi's shoulders. Aside from his ability to recuse himself, you could have rabbinical courts are not one rabbi, it's multiple. But they could have an arbitrator, they could have a negotiator. There are all sorts of ways they could do it. Stephen?
The rabbi has witnesses that verify the situation that occurred.
Right. So in other words, because you're pursuing truth and you know what the truth is, maybe it's inappropriate for you to pursue a compromise. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Because that is another side to this. Right? We talk about people pursuing peace and wanting to have a resolution between them. But let's say you have the following case. Let's say John stole a sweater from Bob. And there are witnesses to that effect. And they show up in the court. And the rabbi recommends, you know, let's try to come up with a compromise between you. Rather than say, let's hear the witnesses and then end up returning the sweater. He wants to come up with peace between them. The result can be that what he's going to do is to thwart justice. Because what should happen is Bob should get his sweater back. And it's not going to happen now. Now he'll say, John, give the sweater to Bob, but Bob, you have to pay John half the value of the sweater. Or he's going to come up with some kind of compromise. I mean, cases are more complicated than that, and we can come up with better examples. The point is, you're cheating truth. There's somebody in that case who had the right to receive, the legal right to receive more, and now he's coming out behind because he went to the court and chose to go with a settlement. Maybe that's not the best solution, and in fact, you find three different views in the Talmud. Take a look, please, at source number 16. The term that's going to be used here for compromise is splitting. Not to be confused with spitting from source number 14. Different story. Don't do that in rabbinical court. Bad idea. Unless the rabbis tell you to. The source number 16. Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Yossi of Galil, said, splitting is prohibited. And one who splits is a sinner. Meaning the judges are not supposed to recommend that they come to a compromise. Rather, let the law pierce the mountain. And he quotes a verse from Deuteronomy, for justice is for God. And so Moses would say, let the law pierce the mountain. Whereas Aaron, the high priest, the brother of Moses, of Moshe, is known for loving peace and pursuing peace. And the Talmud gives you stories about how he would try to create peace between parties. But it's not the point right now. The point right now is Rabbi Eliezer's position is justice. There's a value of justice, and that has to come first. And that's the first view. Second view, Rabbi Yehoshua, son of Karcha, said, it is a mitzvah to split. He said, absolutely not. The mitzvah is that the judges should try to pursue compromise first. And he quotes you a verse from Zechariah. The verse says, truth and justice of peace you shall judge in your gates. And the Talmud is bothered. What does that mean? Truth and justice of peace. In the Hebrew, it's emet umishpat shalom. You're supposed to pursue truth and justice of peace. The Talmud says, I don't know what you're talking about. If there's justice, that means that one guy is going to walk away unhappy. Whoever loses is going to be upset. And so there won't be peace. I know this is against the chant, no justice, no, don't worry about that. This isn't a protest rally. Where there is justice, if there is a loser, there won't be peace. And if there is peace, meaning that each side got something, then you won't have executed justice. How do you have justice of peace? And his answer is, because that's what a compromise is. When you have a compromise, you will have a verdict that will be peaceful, but will still honor the principles of justice. Now, the mechanics of how that's done are very interesting, but beyond the scope of what we're going to do right now, it could be a topic for another series. It's a, you know, how do you do this in a way that preserves justice while still making peace is interesting. But Rabbi Yehoshua, son of Karcha, says, you're supposed to go for the compromise. And then there's a third view, which I'm just going to say outside of the text there, which suggests it depends on what state of litigation you're at. Before you know where things are inclined, pursue compromise. But once you have a sense of what the truth is, it's inappropriate for you to go back to the litigants and suggest a compromise because you're harming one of the parties. You already know which one should have won. And now you're telling that person, I want you to go with something lesser. That's the third approach. Yes. Well, Solomon there is actually using compromise only as a feint, right? He's only saying that in order to try to determine who the real mother is, right? In that story, you remember the story, his statement is to split only so that he will, you know, draw out the real mother. Yeah. Yes. Yes. In that sense, yes.
In cases where there may be harm coming to one of the parties, if there isn't a judgment, which would be another reason for making a judgment. I mean, I guess you have to assess each case individually, but there could be cases where someone, by not making a judgment, would continue having harm perpetrated on that party. I'm thinking of abuse cases.
Right. Right. So that's right. If there's a concern about ongoing harm, that may change entirely the way we look at it. True. The point is, yeah.
This is the beginning of mediation.
Yeah. Absolutely. absolutely. I don't know if it's the beginning of it, but it's certainly an example of it. And in fact, I used this when I taught a class for lawyers on the issue of sue or settle, which one is the lawyer supposed to pursue. This is a foundation text for that discussion. But what I want to show you here is the different point of views. As a matter of Jewish law, when Maimonides addresses this, he follows the view of Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, which is that it is a mitzvah to split. And I think that this is particularly important when we talk about household peace, not so much in terms of what we're supposed to do, because I think it's clear that within a household we're supposed to pursue peace and compromise rather than each person standing on their rights, but the attitude that one takes to it. If my attitude of pursuing compromise is, fine, we need to get through the day, so therefore I will give up on my rights. I wanted to go here, she wanted to go there. You know, last time we went where I wanted to go, so this time I'll go where she wants to go because that way we'll be able to get along. If that's my approach, I'm in trouble. Because it just means I'm going to have resentment, and I'm going to be keeping track. And the next time a situation comes up, I'm going to say, aha, last time we went where you wanted to go. This time we're going to go where I want to go. That's a recipe for disaster. Rather, what I would suggest, and what Maimonides is suggesting by siding with Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, Rabbi Yeshua son of Karcha, is to say, it is a mitzvah to promote peace. It is a positive value. This is something that is not, well, I'm stuck, so let's make peace. It is, that's the goal. The goal is not to get my way. The goal is to create peace, and the feeling when one engages in a compromise is, I got what I wanted. We had peace. That's what I'm suggesting here, is that Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha is promoting what we call in Talmudic language, lechatchila versus bidyeved. Anyone familiar with the term bidyeved? Bidyeved means once it's already done. That's an Aramaic term. It's really a compound of two words. Once it's already done. Lechatchila is initially. This is what I want to do. If compromise is, well, we're stuck, so this is the best way for us to manage, people are going to be miserable. But if compromise is, this is lechatchila, that's what I wanted. What I wanted all along was that we should do something that will work for everybody, then I think that the feelings will be more positive and it will work better going forward. Well, I think we saw already, locked them out of the house, right? That was the... Oh my. Why, Ian? Let me skip that one for now, okay? Yes?
I'm not sure compromise always ensures peace. There is often a resentment. There's a feeling that I've been done wrong.
Right.
I mean, there's all kinds of emotions that are stirred up.
Correct. If part of my happiness is not that person is happy, therefore I am happy, then yes, there will always be that resentment. There will always be that feeling of I've been cheated, I was taken advantage of, and so on. What is needed is that the happiness of the other has to be part of my value system. It has to be something that is important to me. If I am happy because she's happy, then we're good. But that's what a relationship is. It's, you, no one here needs me to tell them that. This is the basics of a marriage, hopefully. A last item that I brought you at number 17, and then we're going to move on to the next topic, is just an interesting note. The practice of lighting Shabbat candles is meant to bring honor to the day, but it's primarily presented in the Talmud as preserving peace within the home. If you don't have light, people trip, the meal is miserable, they're upset. People are upset when they're living in the dark, they're tense, they're nervous, it doesn't go well. And by lighting candles, the idea is not just it presents a nice atmosphere for the day, but you actually are increasing peace in the home. And so the Talmud asks a question. What if you have somebody who is impoverished? and they can't afford fuel, oil, candles, whatever it is. And they have a few different mitzvot available to them, of which they can afford some, but not all of them. So first it says in number 17, if they can only afford to buy enough oil to use either for the menorah or for Shabbos candles. Now, the menorah is very important. This is a mitzvah that overrides most other mitzvot. Lighting the menorah as publicizing the miracle is very important. Nonetheless, the Talmud says, Shabbat candles win. Why? In order to preserve peace in the home, peace trumps celebrating the miracle of Hanukkah. This is always ironic to me, because I remember as a kid that, you know, lighting the menorah was always it was like a flashpoint. You know, there was going to be a fight between the kids. It was going to be because yours was in front of mine, or you went first, or whatever it was. This was always a moment when, put enough children in the room together, there was going to be some kind of fight. But he says, peace will actually trump lighting the menorah. Between Shabbat candles and Kiddush, what if you can only afford either oil for the menorah, for the Shabbos candles, or wine for Kiddush? Shabbos candles win. Better to skip Kiddush and to have the light within the home, which I think is a strong statement in its own right. What I wanted to show you is something even more striking here. What's the minimum length of time that the Hanukkah candles are supposed to stay lit? Half an hour. Right? Half an hour after the after nightfall is the length of time. That's all that you actually need, which means that what we're saying is, for the Shabbat candles, if I'm choosing between the two of them, I'm only adding half an hour of light Friday night by saying Shabbat candles over the menorah, because that's the minimum that it would have been for the menorah. So what you're telling me is, half an hour of peace in the home Friday night with this light is more important than the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles. That 30 minutes is sufficient to override the celebration of Hanukkah. So I thought that was a very strong statement, and one worth contemplating. But that brings us to